Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say. I'm Anu Anand. Now, before we start, I just want to let you know that on Monday, World Have Your Say moves to a different time. We'll be on at 14 hours GMT. That's our new time slot. So after today, if you want to tune in live, make sure you do it several hours earlier. That's 14 hours GMT starting on Monday. Later in this program, we'll talk about a new law passed in the American state of Indiana. The governor says it protects religious freedoms, but its critics, which include major American sports and Hollywood stars, as well as business leaders and politicians, say it promotes bigotry and institutionalizes discrimination. We'll explain the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and we'll be hearing from those who are for and against it. And in a moment, pilots, depression, mental health, and mass murder. We'll discuss all the issues surrounding news that the co-pilot of the Germanwings plane that was deliberately crashed in the Alps had suffered depression and was being treated, we don't know quite yet for what, at a university hospital. You can post on facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay or tweet us using the hashtag WHYS. You can also tweet me directly at @sacred_cows. Now, in the news today, torn up sick notes were found in the homes of Andreas Lubitz, the co-pilot who's accused of deliberately crashing the Germanwings plane in the Alps, including one note for the actual day of the crash. These details have put the focus on how pilots are psychologically assessed. We're going to talk about that, as well as how mental health generally impacts people at work. Studies show that working is good for those suffering depression, but clearly there are critical issues of safety to be addressed as well. Whatever drove Lubitz to destroy the plane, the very real outcome is 150 people dead. One rescue official today said not a single body has been found intact so far at the recovery site. Let's go to the BBC's Anna Holligan, who's in Montabaur in Germany, where Andreas Lubitz lived with his parents. Anna, bring us up to date on what's been revealed today about him.
Now, some fascinating and chilling detail. The sun has just set over Andreas Lubitz's family home here. Two police cars have just driven by, and you might be able to hear the hum of generators. There are half a dozen satellite trucks still parked inside this normally quiet cul-de-sac in a residential neighborhood. Now, just to bring you right up to date with all of the developments from this afternoon, the prosecutor confirmed that they'd found a sick note ripped up in his apartment. And then a medical clinic in Dusseldorf confirmed that they had been treating Andreas Lubitz and that his most recent appointment, they said, was on the 10th of March. And that, of course, was exactly 2 weeks before the crash. However, they did go on to deny the reports that he was being treated for depression. And mental health groups this evening have released a joint statement condemning this widespread speculation that the crash had anything to do with reports of depression, saying it only adds to the stigma surrounding mental health.
That's indeed what we're hearing from a lot of people. We'll be talking about that. Anna, thank you very much indeed. Let's speak to pilots about psychological screening. Captain Tom Bunn is a former United Airlines pilot and also a licensed therapist. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much, Anu.
And George Velasquez is a co-pilot with an American commercial airline. He joins us from Los Angeles in California. Welcome to you, George.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Captain Bunn, you first. Can you talk to us about how much or how often or if at all pilots are screened for depression or any other issues to do with mental health?
Well, each year pilots have a physical and a doctor will have a conversation with you, and it's pretty casual, but I would think that that would be useful for a doctor to pick up some clues if there might be something. The very fact that it is informal may be useful, but there's no formal screening. There's no tests given, but at the same time, the research says that tests don't do very well to suicidality, so maybe that's just as well.
I was just going to ask you whether you think there should be tests. George Velasquez, what do you think? Should there be formalized tests?
I personally don't think we should go beyond what, you know, my colleague has stated, that the, you know, it's kind of a casual you know, conversation between you and your aviation medical examiner once a year when you have your, as an airline pilot, when you have your medical. Yeah, I don't think we should go beyond that. I think it would be a knee-jerk reaction when we still yet have a lot to learn pending the results of the investigation of the event.
Indeed. But I was reading today one pilot talking about how he has flown, and, you know, often you'll get a co-pilot who's just going through something in their personal life, whether it's a divorce or financial problems, and that they're afraid to speak up, that, you know, there is a huge amount of pressure, and that he felt that when you're flying with someone like that, it just increases the pressure on the person who isn't going through any problems, and that perhaps, you know, there should be some kind of a more formal mechanism to deal with these problems.
Well, some airlines are very good and would say, well, look, if you don't feel emotionally up to it today, you're going through a divorce or whatever, we don't want you in the cockpit. And other airlines, I've actually flown at two different airlines, and the other airline said, look, you're a pilot, you're supposed to be able to deal with this, go get it. And it's a remarkable difference between the two airlines, and I suppose with the financial pressures on airlines now, it's more likely to go to, hey, you're supposed to handle anything, go ahead and fly.
George,
I'm fortunate enough that the company I work for, usually the chief pilot, if we have any personal issues, he's very approachable, and he'd much rather you be able to deal with your personal matters on the ground in a controlled environment rather than to have somebody up there who may be physically in the aircraft but not be mentally operating. I think this event is, if anything, it's going to shed light on a maybe an underlying issue that doesn't necessarily have to be fixed with any new regulation, but it will, you know, just like the with having the third or the additional crew member come in and take the place of a pilot leaving the cockpit, the European airlines decided to implement that rule immediately. I think in the short term, I think the airlines will probably, it'd be better for them to adapt something more organic, if you will, rather than implement new regulation.
You know, a lot of people listening to both of you are going to be hearing you arguing that, you know, the informal way of dealing with this is the best way. That's going to be scary for a lot of passengers. Isn't there any legal requirement for pilots to disclose health issues?
Well, this gets tricky, you know, because you are supposed to disclose it. Yeah. But you also know that the way the game is played, if you disclose it, sure, if you have a temporary problem, then as George said, your chief pilot, if he's approachable, will say, sure, take a few days off. But if it's a matter of depression, if you seek treatment for depression, the FAA will pull your license. And you know that if you seek treatment, or if you let anyone know you're seeking treatment or getting treatment, you're going to be out of a job. And so the whole thing goes underground. So what we're first talking about is the kind of temporary thing where a person would have, perhaps when they're flying, be a bit distracted by their personal problems. And that isn't going to do anything more than perhaps make someone make a mistake. But what happened in this case was far more than just a distracting situation that led to a mistake. This is different. And if a person is really suffering depression, we can either deal with it in a more enlightened way. And if a pilot needs treatment, let them have it. But I think the FAA takes the attitude that we're not going to deal with it that way.
Well, George, I mean, in that context, does the torn-up sick note in this case make sense? I mean, we don't know exactly what happened, but the fact that the pressures on a pilot, economically and otherwise, are to hide, you know, any kind of depression or mental health issue, it makes sense then, perhaps, that, you know, these sick notes were not shared.
Yeah, you know, it almost seems like it's almost like an incentive. He's like, if he goes, and like my colleague here said, if he goes through and, you know, seeks professional help, it's almost like he's going to be punished. You know, I had a former flight student who did attempt to commit suicide a few years back, and when he was trying to pursue his private pilot's license, you know, in the questionnaire given to you prior to applying for your aviation medical, you have to disclose that. And, you know, you have to be truthful, because if found otherwise, then, he can have repercussions. But as a result, you know, it delayed his process. He was still able to get his license. However, he still had to, had to go through the process of getting a doctor's note and, proving, in fact, that he had gone through treatment and that he's been reformed. And he's flying today and he's doing very well. But, I think that if a pilot does have personal mental issues, if he's proactive and he seeks help, he shouldn't be, he shouldn't be punished. The FAA should say, okay, you know what, take whatever time you need, or your company. And, it should be something between your examiner and the patient, and not necessarily between the FAA, in my personal opinion.
Well, let me ask you both this, because we are talking at the moment about pilots and mental health, not just generally. Do you think people have a right to expect that pilots should be barred from flying if they have known mental health issues?
Well, that's a tough one.
It is, but it then becomes a question of what's practical. If you are hired and you don't have mental health problems, then okay, so you're working and then you develop something. If you seek treatment, you may end up not having a job. If you disclose that you have a problem, you may not have a job. The public, of course, has a right to be protected. But I think this is perhaps parallel to what happened with alcohol. Many years ago, the airlines, if they found a pilot had a drinking problem, they just... And so the whole thing went underground. In fact, we used to cover for pilots who were drinking, frankly, because there were several of us in the cockpit back in those days, three persons in the cockpit. If somebody had a drinking problem, let him sleep. I'll go ahead and fly the plane for him.
Right.
And but the airlines got wise and said, all right, we're going to... this is an illness. It's not a personality problem that a person is not a good kind of person. This should be treated. So the pilots union and the airlines got together and said, if a pilot has a problem, we want you other pilots to, instead of covering for them, tell the union. The union will go to the pilot and say, look, the company's going to work with you. We want you to go into a program and get treatment. And the whole program worked. Everything then was no longer underground. The airlines that took the enlightened view have had no alcohol problems. There's a few airlines that still took the hard view, and they have the problem underground, and they continue to have problems.
That's a really interesting point. Let's talk then about the stigma now these days around mental health. I want to introduce both of you to Stephanie Boland. She's a journalist who writes for the New Statesman. And Stephanie, you wrote a piece in the New Statesman that is responding to some of the headlines in the UK on this story. For example, killer pilot suffered from depression. Another one read, why on earth was he allowed to fly? Tell us about your piece and the point that you're making.
Hi, Anna. So the point that I'm making is that the press obviously have, some would say, an obligation to delve into this kind of information. But what we've found over and over again with mental health reporting in the UK is that the coverage of these issues tends to be fairly insensitive and at worst salacious and very harmful. We have press guidelines on mental health reporting which ask journalists to be sensitive because it's vulnerable individuals who are involved. And what happened today is the newsstands were covered in headlines which almost went through the guidelines and tried to see how many they could break in 10 words. And my argument was that this is a sensitive matter. It's obviously very painful for the families and for those involved, but also very painful for those in the country who are passing these, who may be suffering from depression and in work, who have to pass by headlines that essentially stigmatise what they're going through.
Captain Bunn, you're a pilot as well as a licensed therapist. What do you think needs to change, not just in the airline industry, but generally, to deal with people who are having mental health issues, but clearly who need to work and want to work and should be allowed to work?
Well, I think that when people think about an airliner, they sometimes think if there's just one little screw loose, the plane's going to crash. That's not the way it is. George and I think everybody in aviation knows that you expect things to go wrong. Sometimes the mechanic's going to make a problem. you know that pilots are going to make mistakes, so you set up the airplane so that if mistakes are done or if there's a backup, and then there's a backup for the backup. That's what works. The problem with this tragedy is there wasn't a backup. We should know that there's going to be mental problems with people, and we should have a backup in place. The European airlines should have had a backup in place, just like the U.S. airlines did, so that if there was a problem, it wouldn't end up as a tragedy.
The U.S. has a rule that two people must be in the cockpit at all times. So if the pilot goes out, then a crew member must come in. Stephanie, I wonder what your reaction was to hearing George and Tom there talking about how much pressure there is to hide mental illness in the aviation industry. The fact that you'd be punished for revealing it.
I thought it was quite alarming, but not unfortunately surprising. And it's something that happens across a range of different professions and industries, including some very high stakes ones. I know a lot of GPs, doctors in the UK have spoken about this recently. But I was very interested in what you were saying about the idea that unpredictable things will always happen. I feel so much of this reporting has gone because this man had a history of depression. He ought to have been barred for life. My point would be there's no way you can predict every incident or legislate against these unpredictable things. All you can do is prepare in case they do occur.
Yes.
George, is that you coming in?
Yes, yes, ma'am. And I totally agree with her because, Tom said, is you know, there should have been a backup plan. I think irrelevant to it is the first officer in
George, your line is just scrambled a bit. I'm just going to let the engineers fix that. But stay with us, and I want to introduce all of you to two other guests. Jen Ronan is in Limerick in Ireland. She's a former school teacher and now a freelance writer and blogger. Welcome to you, Jen.
Hello, how are you? Great to talk
very,
to you.
Very well. Good to talk to you. And Zoe Alicia is in Dublin in Ireland and works in communications. Welcome to you, Zoe.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
We want to talk now about just what it's like to live with depression. And Jen, I actually saw one of your tweets earlier today. I'm just going to read it out because it sort of builds on what Stephanie was saying. And you said, "Dear hysterical media, I have depression, but I don't feel like killing innocent people because mass murder isn't a symptom. Get a grip." I'm sensing that you also found the coverage quite insensitive.
Yeah, I just thought that it was very, I was reading the journal. Sorry, my voice is gone. You bear with me. I was reading on other websites that it's a very simplistic view to say that it was depression that caused this. I mean, this was an act of mass murder. It was an act of somebody who, obviously, there's a lot of issues going on. You know, when I was dealing with depression and kind of reading up on it, I often heard that depression is kind of described as anger turned inward. And to me, what he did seemed like a lot of anger turned outward, you know, and there's a lot of people that I know who suffer with depression and anxiety tend to be quite insular, and it's all turned inward. There's no sense of wanting to make everybody else suffer. I mean, in my darkest days, I wouldn't have wished that on my worst enemy. So the fact that somebody would have depression that would want to take a whole bunch of people down with them, it just seems very, very simplistic. I mean, there's obviously a whole lot more going on there, including lack of procedure to do with, you know, him getting his, you know, the sick note and all this kind of thing. It just seems quite alarming that they would focus on just this aspect of him, just to get a headline. Like Stephanie said, you know, if you can fit it into 10 words and frighten the life out of people, it's going to work better than a reasonable assumption, you know?
Well, I want to... Go ahead. I don't want to stop you. Please go ahead.
We're talking about the incentive, and they are perhaps saying that people should be barred from doing whatever if they have a mental illness of some sort. Okay, but if they want people screened, then if I was the therapist screening the people who are insensitive in the media, I would consider that a highly visible red flag. I would consider that they are the people who perhaps need to not be in a public position.
But that's a very interesting point, Tom Bunn.
Yes, I agree.
I've never been psychologically screened, but I hope that I'm fit to perform this duty. But I just want to, Jen and Zoe, I want to ask you all to just describe for us what have been some of the darkest days that you've dealt with depression and what that's been like. Because if we're going to talk about depression and not stigmatizing it, then we may as well talk about what it's actually like and how you've dealt with it. Zoe, just tell us a bit about the depression that you've experienced.
Yeah, well, I was about 18 when I was diagnosed with depression. And basically, I'd moved away from home, started university, and it was just a really difficult time for me. So it started off just a really low mood. I lost my appetite. I couldn't sleep. It was kind of the typical list of symptoms of depression. That's what I was going through. And yes, there were times when I was suicidal. There were times when, you know, I just couldn't function in day-to-day life. I couldn't leave my bedroom.
And how did that affect, Zoe, how did that affect working? Did you work at the time and how did you cope?
I wasn't working at the time. I was a student in university. But I couldn't go to some of my classes, or I'd go to my classes and just break down in tears during them. So it was really difficult. And until I went and got professional help, and when I started to manage my depression, I could not have performed in my day-to-day life. But I think that's the difference, and that's what needs to be stated here, is that you can recover, that you can manage your depression. And I think what a lot of this has been focusing on is that if you have depression, you should never work again. And that is not true in the slightest. You can have depression and continue to live an extremely happy, fruitful life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm just agreeing. Zoe hit the nail on the head there. I found that when I was diagnosed at 23, but looking back, I was probably prone to depression and really high anxiety from a teenage, from about 14 to 15 upwards. And I would do things like, because I was quite anxious, I would not sleep either. I'd get up very, very early because I'd be afraid that no alarm clock in the world would get me up and I'd be late. And this kind of level of anxiety, trying to explain to people who were, I mean, a normal level of anxiety is the kind of stuff that gets you up in the morning and gets you dressed. And but when you're crippled with anxiety, it's like cold blood running in your body. And it's like the feeling that, I don't know if you've ever been like late for an interview or late for a job and you're on your way to the job and you know you've got like a big telling off ahead of you and this sense of dread. And to me, that was what my everyday living was like. I would sit down and I would try and take a deep breath and I could never get a deep enough breath to kind of calm myself down.
But Jen, that's an extremely illustrative, that's a very good description of it. Stay there, all of you, because we'll carry on talking about mental health and working and what the rules should be, if there should be any. Just a couple of comments to share with you quickly. Josh Hyde writes, depression doesn't make you kill 149 people in a terrifying and horrific way. Prene says, passengers can't and should not be knowing about the health issues of pilots. It doesn't serve any purpose. And Moses writes, there need to be three pilots in the cockpit every time. Human beings are not angels. We'll be back in just a moment after a break for the news. And remember, on Monday, World Have Your Say is on at 14 hours GMT.
A richer world from the BBC World Service. Detroit was once the engine of America. Today, large swathes of Motor City lie in ruin. But some Detroit locals are determined to help.
For $5, you get soup, salad, bread, and a vote. What you're voting on are creative projects that are making the city better.
Detroit Soup is a community crowdfunding project which has raised thousands of dollars to bring the city back to life.
Getting them all under one roof, taking the collection at the door, and then literally funding a project that same night, that seems to be quite a remarkable thing.
Now Detroit Soup's founder, Amy Cahill, finds out if the same idea could work in Nepal.
It can happen, I think, anywhere, with anyone, anytime.
Can soup change the world? On the BBC World Service. Online at bbcworldservice.com.
This is World Have Your Say from the BBC. I'm Anu Anand. The German Wings co-pilot who deliberately crashed into the Alps may have suffered depression. Our guests say pilots with mental health issues should not be allowed to fly. Others are making the point that equating depression with mass murder helps no one. And we'll be live in Indiana, where a new law on religious freedom may also promote discrimination. That's coming up. Hello, welcome back to World Have Your Say. I'm Anu Anand. Now, on Monday, we move to a different time. World Have Your Say will be live on air at 14 hours GMT. That is our new time slot. So after today, if you want to tune in live, please make sure you do it several hours earlier. That's 14 hours GMT starting on Monday. Of course, you can always listen again if you search for World Have Your Say at bbc.co.uk. Now, later in the program, we'll hear from Indiana in the US, where critics of a new religious freedom law fear that it will promote discrimination. We'll be debating where that line between freedom and discrimination lies. And we're still speaking to pilots and those suffering depression after news that the co-pilot who's accused of deliberately crashing the Germanwings plane into the Alps had hidden a sick note from his employers, including one that covered the day of the crash itself. We're on facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. You can also tweet us using the hashtag WHYS. Let me just quickly reintroduce my guests. Captain Tom Bunn is a former United Airlines pilot and a licensed therapist. We're also speaking to Stephanie Boland, a journalist who's written in the New Statesman today, calling on the media to exercise much more sensitivity when it comes to reporting on mental health. Jen Ronan is in Limerick, Ireland. She's been living with depression and is managing it. And Zoe Alicia is also in Ireland, works in communications. And Zoe, you've also been telling us about how you were diagnosed with depression in your late teen years, early 20s. I wanted to speak to you about working and depression. You were saying that as a student, it did affect you, didn't go to class very much. But to both of you, I want to talk about how free or how encouraged do you feel in being able to talk about it at work? Is it easy to talk to an employer to say, I'm having a bit of trouble, I may need some help, or I may need some time off? Zoe?
For me, I'm actually at the stage now where my depression doesn't affect me in the way it did back then. When I first was experiencing depression, I was quite immobilized by it, to be honest. Now I'm at the stage where I still have depression, I still have my downs, but it's not to the extent where I feel like I cannot take time off work or I have to take time off work. But that isn't to say that if anything did come up, that I wouldn't deal with it. Actually, my employers all know about my mental illness and my mental health history. It's actually something I did feel completely comfortable talking to them about.
What did you say to them, Zoe? I just wonder, because I can't imagine having to have that conversation. It's a tough conversation to have.
The truth is that I didn't have to. It was by choice that I told them. Honestly, it's because of my experiences with mental health and coming out the other side a stronger person than I was when I was first experiencing it. It's what inspired me to get into communications. As you said, that's what I do. And I do work with a lot of charities and with a mental health organization in Ireland, Sea Change. I work with them as well. And so for me to be talking about why I got into my job, it actually does come back to, well, I had depression and I was diagnosed with it. And because of what I went through, I now want to make a change in the world.
Jen, you have a blog in which you've written about dealing with depression. Me and my shadow 5 years on, I like that. what was it like for you? I mean, how able were you to talk openly about it?
Well, I'm lucky now because being a freelance writer and blogger, you can pretty much say whatever you want. So it's up to you how much you want to reveal. And it's up to people whether they want to know about it or not. And it doesn't really affect anybody adversely. I qualified as a teacher in 2011. And I worked for, I think, just over a year subbing in different schools. And it at the time, like Zoe, my depression and the symptoms were all under control. I was on regular medication and everything was totally fine and I had no issues. What happened then was in 2013, at the start of 2013, I lost my mother. She died quite suddenly from an illness. And what happened then was, in addition to the normal shock and bereavement that you go through, it seemed to trigger off all of the other symptoms of depression as well. More depressed than anxious, which is my normal kind of mode of depression would have been anxiety, but it went into depression. And I ended up, I think I came back after a week and a bit and went back into work. And to be honest, it was the best thing I ever did for me. And I think for the kids as well, because the kids were talking and there had been some bereavements in the classroom where I had been working as well. So actually it made for quite an open dialogue with the kids because they'd come up and say to you, you know, they were very open and they'd say, oh, so-and-so died. And I'd be like, oh, you know, So I found it quite good. But I think it depends on the school and your relationship maybe with the principal of the school or whatever. I mean, I certainly wouldn't have run in if I didn't know the principal. And at that stage, I had subbed for the school for a bit. So when I went in...
Or Jen, even the industry, Stephanie, I mean, as a journalist, is that something you can, the newsrooms are I imagine, just, well, I don't have to imagine, they're really tough places. You know, how do you walk in there on a heavy news day and say, listen, you know, I'm just not feeling up to it? That's a tough, it is a tough conversation to have.
I think it's a tough conversation to have. I mean, I suppose, like both Zoe and Jen were saying, it depends very much exactly where you're working. Journalism is definitely the sort of industry where it can be hard to take time off purely because part of it is keeping up with breaking news. So if you close off your email for a day, you turn it back on and it's full of PR announcements and things. But I know at the New Statesman in particular, I was asking about this earlier, and we ran a mental health week and invited our writers to contribute. And normally when we run these themed weeks, we get, you know, one or two pieces in. And this time, every journalist who writes for us regularly seemed to have a personal experience to bring to it. So it seems to be something that's quite common in the industry, but maybe not spoken about so much publicly.
Tom, I know you want to come in, but let me just two things. Let me introduce Professor Robert Bohr, who's a former pilot and psychologist, so somewhat in the same line as you. And I want to share this comment. This was from our Facebook page. Nathan Hazlett wrote, this is again back to the German Wings case. If it's proven that he deliberately sabotaged the plane, his actions were beyond reprehensible. Evil is a word that comes to mind. I am wary of attacking a dead man before we know all of the facts, and it is worth pointing out millions have suffered from depression. It is a powerful thing. But there should be no sympathy for this man, his family and the other families, but not him, if he has really done what is being reported. Tom, I just wonder your reaction to that. No sympathy.
Well, yeah, I think, let me go back to something that happened at the break. You mentioned someone tweeted, a person with depression doesn't kill 150 people. That's true. And I'm sure that a lot of people who are thinking exactly that. So then if it wasn't depression, what was it? And I'm sure that there's very few people who would come up with this, but my therapist hat, I have to think about the possibility of schizoid personality disorder. Schizoid means split. And what that means is that a person is psychologically split within that they have a great emptiness inside, and they do not, life doesn't have juice, but they function. They hold themselves function, but throughout their whole life, they're teetering on the edge of, is life worth living? And when they live their whole lives on the edge of suicide, they very well, if something very easily just push them over to that other side where they feel it doesn't make sense to live anymore. Mm-hmm. And what happens is, and this I want to try to make clear, when a person reaches that point, they have no interest in themselves, no investment in themselves, investment in continue to live. Nothing has any value. And the lives of the people on the plane mean nothing at all. Killing themselves then becomes simply an interesting technical experience.
Well, okay, this is exactly what I want to talk about, Professor Bohr, with you, because, you know, this is what people are trying to get their heads around, that it's one thing to be depressed and to feel that you have no reason to live. It's quite another to take 149 people down with you.
Well, absolutely. You know, I think we, as you seem to be all suggesting, we need to separate depression, low mood, from suicidal intent and suicidal behaviors. There can be people who have low mood who are not suicidal, and there can be people who are suicidal who strangely are actually not depressed as well. The two often go together, but not necessarily. And, you know, if we think in terms of depression and suicide, I think we're thinking of quite extreme kinds of depression. When people think about committing suicide, a number of things have to line up. It's not usually a simple impulsive act. There needs to be a number of agreements present. Typically, it would include depression, struggling with something, whether it's a condition or medical condition, condition.
It would just Professor Bohr, we are slightly having trouble with your line. I'm just going to talk over you for a minute to see if we can maybe clear it up, because I'm really interested in what you're saying, that there are so many factors involved here. It's not just being suicidal or being depressive. Let me share just a couple of comments while we get that line cleared up. This is from our Facebook page. Hans writes, was the co-pilot on psychotropic medicines? People who commit mass murder often are. That's perhaps a question for one of you. There's another one here. Matt Haig tweets, Buzz Aldrin flew rockets. Abraham Lincoln was an American president. Many of the greatest, most responsible people have been depressives. Let me see if we can come back to you, Professor Bohr. Now, let's see if that line is any better. Are you there? Perhaps not quite yet. Tom Bunn, what do you make of what he was saying there, that there are so many different aspects to this? It's not just depression or simply being suicidal.
Yeah, I really think that he's correct when he says that you can't just say that this is caused by depression. There's other dimensions. And what are those dimensions? And here's something I'd like to say. This may turn out to open up a can of worms, but the job of being a pilot is a very detached job. You're detached from the Earth. You spend half of your life in some other part of the globe. If you have intimate relationships or close relationships, you look perfectly normal. But it isn't. You see, you need a certain amount of detachment in order to do something that has risk. As an airline pilot, there's really not much risk, but when you're learning to fly, there is. And so a certain amount of detachment and schizoid qualities are useful in certain professions. And the problem is when it goes really deep, then it's really potentially a problem. Yeah. Now, I think that there's very little known in the general public about schizoid personality disorder, but it's a fascinating disorder, and I think that all of us have a little edge of it.
Well, we're clearly going to be possibly finding out more about the co-pilot, and of course, we will carry on covering that story, obviously, for the next few days, certainly. But I just wanted to thank Captain Tom Bunn, as well as Stephanie Boland, Jen Ronan, Zoe Alicia, and although we only heard from him for a minute or so, Professor Robert Bohr, who's a former pilot and psychologist.